It's a fascinating book. It's a fascinating the story of this person called Job. And I'm just going to provide a quick overview of what we find in the book. Think about who the major characters are, what is going on, and how does the story develop. Well, think about some of the key questions that the book raises and why it's so relevant to some of the questions that we face today. And then later on in our service, we'll pick up the story again and see what it tells us about how we're encouraged to think about suffering and what it tells us about God and our relationship with him. So the story starts with an idyllic seeming description of the life of someone called Job. One is presented as living a blameless and upright life. He's a good guy. He's got a large family. He's got massive wealth. He fears God. He avoids evil. He's even aware that his children might be doing things that they shouldn't. And so he offers sacrifices on their behalf, so that if they have sinned, God would forgive them. He doesn't just have a care for himself, he has a care for his family. He's described in verse 4 as the greatest man among the people of the East, a sort of Bill Gates of the ancient world, the person who had everything. And later on, we find that he didn't just have these things for himself, but he's respected and he's known for caring for the needy and the poor. Job 29, as he speaks about how he's seen, he says this: "Whoever heard me spoke well of me. Those who saw me commended me, because I rescued the poor who cried for help, the fatherless who had none to assist them." He's the sort of guy who'd have been there at the night shelter for the homeless, caring for those in need. The book and the man are difficult to date. Wide range of theories. Anywhere within about 600 years, people have placed this book. So we don't know. But the questions it raises are timeless and well worth thinking about. So that's something of Job. But then after being introduced to Job, the second half of the passage that Esme read, the scene switches to heaven. And we have this picture of the angels coming to present themselves before God. These angels are creatures whom God has created to serve him and to carry out his wishes. And here they are appearing before him to explain what they're doing and to account for their activities. I remember when a new chief executive joined our company. He got all the department heads to come and present to him. What were they doing? How were they achieving their goals? How were they going to make the company grow and be profitable? And I wasn't there. I was a lowly person in the organisation. But we heard stories. And we heard stories that said, if they didn't have good answers to his searching questions, they were in serious trouble. They were supposed to know what was going on in their departments. And you get the idea that these angels are coming to present to God as to what is going on in the things that they've been given responsibilities for. And it's in that context that we come across another major player. This character called Satan. The one who sets up the drama that's worked out in the rest of the book. He only actually appears in the first two chapters. But what he does is significant. If he hadn't done what he'd done, the story wouldn't have happened. He is presented as one of these created beings, presenting himself to God. And God's got a question for him. He says, are you aware of Job? And have you spotted that he's blameless, that he's righteous? And God is pointing out Job to Satan as an example of humanity at its best. Satan says, yeah, but it's easy. It's easy to trust you, God, when everything's going well. But what about when things are going badly? And so God grants Satan freedom to bring Job down. Everything he has is in your power. But he's not allowed to touch Job himself. Job himself is protected, but anything else is fair game. And so if we'd read on in the next few verses in this chapter, we'd find that Satan goes away and does this. It results in all Job's wealth being taken away and all of Job's children being killed. That's what happens as a result of this scene playing out in heaven. And towards the end of the chapter, with all of this going on, Job refuses to blame God. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised. And commenting on that, the writer says, in all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. And so Job has come through this test. And so we get to chapter 2. The scene is back in heaven. And the angels are coming to present themselves before God again. And Satan is there. And God points out to Satan that even after all you've done, Job is still acting in a righteous way. Verse 3, have you considered my servant Job? Exactly the same question that God asked in chapter 1. There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil. And then God adds on an extra bit. And he still maintains his integrity, though you incited me against him to ruin him without any reason. Satan says, yeah, but it'd be different if I were allowed to afflict Job himself. And so in verse 6, God gives him permission to harm Job, but not to kill him. And Satan does that. Job breaks out in painful sores. He's in great pain. But even in this, Job continues to trust in God. And when his wife encourages him to curse God and die, in verse 9, Job says, shall we accept good from God and not trouble? And again, the writer comments, in all this, Job did not sin in what he said. In many ways, it's a shocking story. The idea of God allowing harm to come on someone, to allow him to suffer much distress, to allow his children to be taken away, seemingly to prove a point. What's really going on in this story? We'll come back to that question a bit later. But just want to cover a couple of things now. First of all, what is meant by this word, by this person, Satan, in the context in which it's used here? We have an understanding of who Satan is and what he does through what we find in the New Testament. We know him as the devil, the one who's totally evil and the one opposed to God. The one who came and tempted Jesus when he was in the wilderness. The one who was there trying to bring us down. But that isn't how he's normally presented in the Old Testament. The term, the word, only appears 27 times in the Old Testament, 14 of them in these first two chapters of Job. And the idea is typically that of an accuser. Not somebody who's evil, not somebody who does wrong, but somebody whose role is to try and point out fault in others. It's like, think of a law court, and this is the prosecution lawyer, the one who tries to make a case against the person who's being accused. And with him roaming throughout the earth, we get the idea that he was looking around to try and identify people who were not loyal to God. So he was doing his job, and God was constraining what he was able to do. God's purpose in all of this seems to be wanting to demonstrate that a human being can live an upright life even when things go against them, people will continue to trust him. We know, because of the understanding that we now have, is that we can only be righteous and pure in God's sight through trusting in Jesus. But that isn't the issue that's being addressed here. It's how do people respond to the reality of life? And so God chooses Job as the greatest example at that time of upright living to demonstrate how people will stay committed to him even through suffering. So Job was to be tested, as we ourselves often are. And James reminds us when he writes his letter that sometimes testing can produce good things in our lives. In James 1 we find, "Blessed is the one who perseveres under trial, because having stood the test, that person will receive the crown of life that the Lord has promised to those who love him." So the scene is set. Job has suffered many, many things. And most of the rest of the book is taken up with exploring the reasons for Job's suffering. What it says about God's character, what it says about justice, what it says about how people are treated. And most of this plays out through conversation. Initially, conversation between Job and three of his friends. Then another of Job's companions join in, a guy called Elihu. And finally, God speaks and engages with Job. One common way of thinking about this book is that it's a trial scene, where Job is being accused of having done evil, which has resulted in his misfortune. But looking a little deeper, there's another trial that is being worked out here, where God is the accused, and Job is the witness for the defence, even if he doesn't want to take on that role. And the question that's being asked is God just? And this is debating something that's known as the retribution principle, that bad things happen to bad people and not to good ones. So people get treated in a way that they deserve. And this is explored under three competing claims. I'm going to sort of demonstrate that with a couple of pictures, if we can have a presentation there, Bob, please. And if we could have the first slide, that'd be great. Yes, thank you. Three competing claims. First is that God is just. God is a God of justice. The second claim is that Job is righteous. We're told that right at the beginning of the story. He was blameless. He was upright. And the third claim is that the retribution principle is true. That bad things happen to bad people. Good things happen to good people. And these are the three claims that are being worked out throughout the story. And as the story unfolds, it becomes clear that it's impossible to hold on to each of those three claims. And so choices are made as to which people are going to hold on to and which they are going to discard. And the first group of people we see is Job's friends who appear, and they take a particular view, and they come to him in his grief, and they end up not being hugely supportive and take the position that the retribution principle applies, it is true. They take the position that God is just. But because Job is suffering, that means that Job must have done something wrong. So they are not holding on to the idea that Job is righteous. And they spend most of the time telling him that. Zophar is a great example of this in chapter 11. If you put away the sin that is in your hand and allow no evil to dwell in your tent, then, free of fault, you will lift up your face, you will stand firm and without fear. So basically, all this is happening to you because you've sinned and you've done wrong and you ought to own up to it, and everything would then be great. So that's where they stand on these claims. Job, however, has a different view. He's maintaining passionately that he is righteous. Job 27, verse 5 and 6. I will never admit you are in the right. Till I die, I will not deny my integrity. I will maintain my innocence and never let go of it. My conscience will not reproach me as long as I live. My conscience is clear. I know that I haven't done anything to justify, to explain what is happening to me. So he knows that he's righteous. He starts to wonder whether the retribution principle then is true. Job 21, verse 7. Why do the wicked live on, growing old and increasing in power? He's seeing things happening that don't stack up to what he's believed. But he finds it difficult to lose that principle completely. So he starts to challenge God's justice. Why, God, is this happening? Job 10, verse 2. I say to God, do not declare me guilty, but tell me what charges you have against me. I just don't know why this is happening, God. What have you got against me? How can this be just? And God himself recognizes what Job is saying. And in chapter 40, when God speaks, he says to Job, would you discredit my justice? Would you condemn me to justify yourself? As God listens to the conversation, he knows that the statements that Job is making suggest that God's justice is in question. So Job is trying to navigate through this and work out what's going on, and he asks hard and difficult questions. So after Job and his three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, have finished their conversation, another person, one who's slightly younger than the others, one who was a bit diffident to speak, joins in. This is a guy called Elihu. And he wants to defend the principle of God's justice. And he goes about it by starting to affirm the retribution principle, chapter 34. He repays everyone for what they have done. He brings on them what their conduct deserves. Saying, yeah, this is how it works. I believe God is just. I believe that right things happen. I don't want to say that Job isn't righteous. So how can I square these things together? What I'll do is in chapter 36, verse 15, he says, those who suffer, he delivers in their suffering. He speaks to them in their affliction. And he's saying, the only way I can get out of this is to recognize that sometimes suffering isn't because people have done something bad, but it's restorative. It helps them grow. God causes his people to go through suffering so that they can grow. And that's the debate that's going on. Does the retribution principle work? Is Job righteous? Is God just? That's the question. There's a tension there that needs to be resolved. As we consider these questions, we recognise they're not just hypothetical. They're not just theoretical. We remember the death of a young baby earlier this week. Tragic, tragic circumstances. Remember an accident just over a week ago where somebody at the Ealing Church was killed in a car accident and left a wife and three children. In the context of conversations that I had with a group of people earlier this week, he was saying, life just doesn't seem fair. What can we make of it? These are real issues which affect real people. How should we engage with them? What do we make of these questions? We'll come back to that later. And we'll see what happens when God joins the conversation. In the first of those two readings that Peter has read, God bursts onto the scene and says that it's time for Job to face him, to engage with him, which is actually what Job has been asking for all along. If we read through the entire book, you see time and time again Job saying, look, I don't really want to talk to you guys. I want to have this conversation with God. I want to understand from God what is going wrong and why this is happening. And that's what I need. I want God to answer my questions. But that's not what happens. Because from those verses up until the second reading, we pretty much have God speaking. He's got a different agenda. He doesn't address the question of Job's suffering. He doesn't address questions of fairness. But he speaks about his greatness. He speaks about his power. He speaks about his majesty. God has something he wants Job to understand. You know, I sometimes wonder how much we need to learn that. That sometimes I think we try and impose our agenda on God, just as Job was trying to. And sometimes when God chooses to speak into our lives and situations, he has his agenda that he wants us to listen to. And when we do that, when we grasp who God is and the greatness of God, then it changes everything. And so instead of answering Job's questions, God starts to speak about the wonders of the creation he has made, the creation that he maintains. And then he says to Job, where do you fit in to this? Verse 4, where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me, if you understand. You know that time, long, long time ago, when I created all of this, where were you? What were you doing at that time? 38, verse 37. Who has the wisdom to count the clouds? Who can tip over the water jars of the heavens? Many, many expressions God uses to demonstrate his power over creation. Not just in making it, but in maintaining it and holding it in its place. And in the light of that, and in the light of saying, well, this is who I am and this is what I do, he asks Job whether people like Job should expect to be able to correct God. Chapter 40, verse 2. Will the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? Let him who accuses God answer him. And here, Job has the opportunity to say, yeah, I know you did some great stuff in creation, but how about me and how about what's going on in my life? But instead, a couple of verses later, he says, well, I'm unworthy. How can I reply to you? I put my hand over my mouth. As though to say, there is nothing I can say in response, having grasped something of the greatness of God. And the key question that God asks in chapter 40, verse 8, outlines the reality of what is going on here. Would you discredit my justice? Would you condemn me to justify yourself? And here God presents Job with the reality of what he's been doing. He's been defending his innocence, he's been crying out against God, and in doing so, even if he didn't use exactly those words, he's accused God of acting unjustly. God has just been explaining how he created and controls the world. And he's making the point that for a human being, with no real understanding of what that involves and no power to do anything about it, to question God's justice is presumptuous and wrong. And for relationships between Job and God to be restored, Job needs to acknowledge that and to recognise that God is righteous and that God's purposes are above his understanding. And as we saw in our final reading, this is the place to which Job comes, as he recognises that he was speaking about things he didn't understand. And with a deeper appreciation of who God was, Job recognises that God is and always will be in the right. And that his attempts to justify himself at the expense of God were wrong. It's not that the retribution principle we were thinking about a few moments ago isn't sometimes valid, but it's too simplistic. God isn't governed by it. He's above it and will do what he chooses to do in order to work out his purposes. So in many ways, the book of Job does help us to reflect on different aspects of suffering and how we respond to them. The bigger question it raises is how we relate to God as we go through that suffering. Who do we think God is? We often say that God is above us and greater than us. He's outside and bigger than all of creation. And that is true. But I sometimes wonder whether in the reality of daily life, we actually treat God and seek to engage with him as though he were a bigger and better version of us. We expect him to do what we would like to do if we were perfect. We expect him to think about things as we think about them on a good day. We expect him to have our approach to fairness and what is right. But what God is saying here is that's not how it works. God is not a bigger version of us, a better version of us. He is unique. He is who he is. He will do what he chooses to do. Yes, he's a God who loves us deeply, intimately, passionately, but not a God who's accountable to us. And I know this doesn't answer the question of why bad things happen to good people, but it can change our perspective on that question. And these issues, these questions have been real for a long, long time. They were real in the time of Jesus. In Luke 13, at the start of Luke 13, we come across a strange story. There were some present at that time who told Jesus about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mixed with their sacrifices. And the idea here is that there were these people in Galilee who were offering sacrifices to God, and Pilate had caused them to be killed. And Jesus answered, "Do you think that these Galileans were worse sinners than all the other Galileans because they suffered this way? I tell you, no. But unless you repent, you too will all perish. Or those 18 who died when the tower in Siloam fell on them, do you think they were more guilty than all the others living in Jerusalem? I tell you, no. But unless you repent, you too will all perish." Here, Jesus is again explaining to his followers that the retribution principle isn't enough. The fact that these particular people died in tragic circumstances doesn't mean that they were worse than anyone else. It challenges those who are left behind as to how they relate to God. There was a time when Jesus heard that his dear, dear friend Lazarus was sick. And he could have gone to heal him, but he chose not to. He waited until Lazarus had died. His priority was not in saving Lazarus or keeping his sisters from having to experience grief over the loss of their brother. His priority was so that God would be glorified. John 11, verse 4 says this: "When he heard this, Jesus said, 'This sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it.'" God's glory does not consist in sparing the faithful the difficulties of life, but in refusing to do so, he shows that he can restore everything, even suffering, through his Son. And so Jesus didn't act in the case of Lazarus so that God would be glorified. And for him to glorify God, he himself had to endure the suffering of the cross. Does the story of Job, do these examples from the life of Jesus give us easy and simplistic answers to the problem of suffering? No. And I think that it's right that is so. Suffering in this broken world is real. we do people a great disservice if we try and make out that there are easy answers. But these stories, these examples, encourage us to look beyond what is going on in our lives, to rest in the reality that God is in control, that God is working out his purposes even when they are beyond our comprehension, and to encourage us to seek to stay faithful to him and to look for evidence of his glory. And our responsibility and privilege is to walk with people through suffering, just as Jesus walked with Mary and Martha as they grieved the loss of their brother. And also to introduce them to the God who will never desert them or leave them alone. The book of Job, the example of Jesus, raise hard questions about the reality of life, about our relationship with God, about who we think God is. But they speak of a God above us, a God who is glorious, a God who is working out his purposes, and a God who journeys with his people, even as they go through those times of suffering. Are we prepared to live with this understanding of God, whatever our circumstances? And are we ready to introduce those who are suffering to the Jesus who walks with us and will walk with them? Let's pray.